It is Wednesday, the 26th of May, 2021. I am Patrick Crozier.
I'm Brian Micklethwaite.
And we're going to talk about the origins of the First World War. And if I remember correctly, in our sort of pre-podcast discussion, we said that I just begin by outlining what happened. And then you'd ask questions and heckle and so forth, yeah?
Generally barge in and monopolise the conversation.
Yes.
I hope not. Yes. So what did happen?
Okay, well, on the 28th of June 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the heir presumptive to the Austrian throne, was assassinated in Sarajevo. The Austrian government blamed Serbia. About a month later, issued a ultimatum to Serbia. Serbia rejected it, and Austria declared war on Serbia. Then Russia mobilized its forces. Germany declared war on Russia and France. Germany's plan was to invade France through Belgium. It invaded Belgium, at which point Britain declared war on Germany. Those are the main events of the origins. There's more to happen. More people join in. Obviously, the Ottoman Empire a bit later in the year. Italy in 1915. The United States in 1917.
Hmm.
So there.
The only bit of the story that I think I properly understand now is why the Brits joined in, which was that they always join in if anybody looks like they're going to dominate the entire continent of Europe, and in particular the coastline of Europe that faces Britain. Because if anyone does that, they are an existential threat to the British state. And not just the British Empire, although that's definitely part of the story, but it's Britain itself that is under threat. And the rulers of Britain have never been prepared to tolerate that.
I have heard various versions of that over the years, but I've never seen it written down, as in a politician, a king, stating that baldly.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not stated by, say, Asquith at the time.
Mm.
That's not a reason or reason that he publicly gives for going to war. I hear it often enough, but I'm just saying, you know, someone should say it. That's my point of view.
Well, I think the British ruling classes understand that their interests and those of their people are not necessarily, shall we say, perfectly aligned, because the people do the dying so that the ruling class can carry on doing the ruling of a formidable nation state. And putting it as bluntly as that wouldn't work. I mean, you wouldn't get the army to fight if you told them that their purpose was to keep their social superiors in a state they had become used to.
And presumably there are risks to even poor people if Britain gets conquered.
Yes, there are, and you can talk about those. You can certainly. I mean, it's always been the case that if there's going to be a war, for Christ's sake, don't have it in your backyard. So don't wait until they're invading your country before you fight. Get your retaliation in first. That's what the British always do.
There's also a point about allies. Much better to fight if you have allies.
Yes.
At your side. In 1914, Britain would have had them. Had he just done nothing, the chances are the Germans would have won. Mm. At which point, Britain would not have had any allies.
That's right. And also, you'd. By the way, it's worth mentioning that we discussed a lot of this in the very first one of these we did recently. Back in 2017, we did a podcast. It's called Brian Micklethwaite and I Chat About the First World War. That's the title you gave the posting. Very short. Not the notes that you've subsequently been in the habit of putting up. But I listened to that. My main piece of homework for this was listening to that entire podcast. And we covered a lot of the ground. I think if I'd known all the things we'd said, I might have hesitated to suggest that we talk about it, as it turned out, again.
Oh.
Because we covered all sorts of things. We covered what you've just said about Asquith. So it's
oh, we
worth
did, okay.
trying to avoid covering the same ground again. I fear that this conversation we're going to have is going to cause me to say, well, frankly, I think you should go and listen to the earlier one because that was better.
Well, maybe we will end up like that, which is, you know, fair enough.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know. I mean, I think the idea was...
All I can say is that since that... the one insight that I realised after that conversation we had in 2017 was that it wasn't imperialism, or it didn't seem like it was imperialism that kicked off the First World War, because all Britain's allies were imperial rivals, and actually at least as formidable imperial rivals as Germany was.
Yeah,
however, what Germany was something else again, and that was a national threat to the nation of Britain. France, America, Russia, none of them were threatening to invade Britain or even in any position to threaten to invade Britain.
No.
Germany, if it succeeded in its war against France and Russia, would then be in a position to invade Britain. And there's every possibility that they might have, if not done it, then made noises about it and said, oh, it would be a shame if we had to become hostile to you. Wouldn't want that, would we? You know, the old
no.
Ooh, look what I've done, I've dropped that vase off your mantelpiece, oops, sorry about that.
And it was a fear, it was a fear that people had well until into 1918.
Yes.
This could happen. So
and the fear of German invasion was a fact of pre-war life in Britain as well. There were various novels written, The Riddle of the Sands, as I recall.
Yes, and I think William Le Queux had a book, I can't remember the title of it, talking about a German invasion. So
yeah.
yes, that's certainly doing the rounds at the time.
Mm. So, I mean, there's a sense in which the British rulers had a story they could tell the British people that... you know, these people will do us no good. We've got to fight them in a place of our choosing, namely France, rather than a place of their choosing, namely the south of England.
Yes, it's interesting the story they do tell at the time. I mean, going through Asquith's statements, it's very much a question of honour. It's very much a statement of, look, there
treaty,
is a treaty here.
Yes.
You know,
you emphasised that in the earlier conversation.
Yeah, did I?
Well, you can't just abandon Belgium. They're our allies. We have a treaty with them.
Yeah.
On the other hand, the Germans have ripped up the treaty they had when they barged into Belgium. They've got to be taught a lesson.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
And the interesting thing is, it's precisely the same argument that was made in 1939.
Yes.
You can't trust the deals these people enter into.
Yeah.
So
can we go back to the of the beginnings of the war in Central Europe?
Mm-hmm.
I get that the Austrians declared war on the Serbians for the reasons you stated. The Serbians didn't obey Austria's orders, so the Austrians had to crush them, presumably because if they didn't, their whole empire would unravel.
That's certainly what they felt.
Yes.
But
the Russians mobilised. Now, why did they not realise what a dangerous thing that might be? It would give the Germans the excuse they were looking for to barge into Russia.
That's a good question. And in the sources I've read, there is very little... You know, very little said about that. Maybe that's something I should we'll read up further on. I think certainly one of the reasons was that Russia thought Serbia needed protection against Austria. I think
presumably there were treaty obligations the Russians felt they had towards the Serbians.
I'm not sure there were. I've never heard of one, but there might have been.
That's interesting. I thought there were.
Oh, dear, there's a good question. Yes, I don't know. I've never heard of them, but...
In that case, it makes the question of why did Russia not appreciate the dangers of what it was doing?
Maybe it did. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much documentation on this, and if there is documentation, I haven't seen it in any book I've read. But they were nervous. This mobilisation they were nervous about, because they start with a partial mobilisation. And I think it goes to full mobilisation, goes to partial mobilisation, goes to full mobilisation. Because on a political level, they want to make it partial. So it's only aimed against Austria. And on a military level, it's made clear, well, actually, Tsar, you have to do both. You have to go the full Monty. Why that is, I'm not clear about, because in 1912...
It's typical of the whole escalation of this thing that you make a military move with a particular aim in mind, but that then creates the possibility that you might do something else with the same army. And that creates fear on the part of another enemy that you hadn't perhaps thought about in the first instance. And that's what happened with the Germans and the British, wasn't it?
That's a good question. I'm just trying to think about... I would have thought... I mean, my vague understanding of the Russian railway system, and this was made in Norman Stone's book on the Eastern Front, is that there isn't much that goes north-south. It's mostly east-to-west. Which means if you mobilise against Austria, actually that's the only people you can fight. You can't fight Germany easily. So I think the Germans may have been... The German wish to go to war was more to do with propping up their ally than actual real fear of the Russian army being used against them.
So they were basically trying to persuade the Russians not to beat up the Austrians. That's what you're saying, is it?
Gosh, is it?
The Germans mobilised in order to deter the Russians from joining in with Serbia against Austria. In other words,
The
Germans had a defensive, what you might call a conservative motive for mobilising, not just an aggressive motive.
Well, yes, I mean, what are they trying to gain from this, I suppose, is the question. Not much, I think I'd have to say.
Yes. In the previous conversation, we discussed the fact that, or you mentioned that there's a story going around in historical circles that the Germans had a plan to attack Russia no later than 1916, I think it was.
I think it was more strategic than that. I think the point that was being made was that they knew that Russia was rearming. I mean, Russia had been through the mill in the Russia-Japanese War, and they were no state to go to war for years afterwards. But they were building up, and it's not just their armament industry and their army they were building up; it was also their railway network.
Certainly,
a lot of German military commentators convinced themselves that by 1916, 1917, it was all over. They couldn't hope to beat the Russians.
You see, there's another example of the same thing. With the Japanese in mind, basically, the Russians rearm, and that immediately makes the Germans jittery, which can't have been the original purpose of the rearmament, but it was likely to be one of its consequences. That you rearm so that you can deal with countries like Japan better than they did in 1905 or whenever it was.
Railways, of course, are another matter. Yes, yeah. You've got the Trans-Siberian, which could be used against Japan, but would be of less use against Russia, and I believe, of course, it's Germany. But railways...
Part of the general building up of Russian military power, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
And the railways just mean that military power can be deployed at any point on the periphery of the Russian Empire. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but looking at it from the point of view of paranoid enemies, it's a fear, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, if there's a big army in Japan and there's a Trans-Siberian railway, then you can switch the army from Japan to Germany in about a week.
Yes, yes, I see the point.
And the Germans are not going to like that. It's their job to notice things like that. I mean, you know, there are whole military departments whose job is to worry about nothing else besides things like that.
No, indeed.
And you can be sure they would point it out to their superiors.
Again, I've never heard that argument that the Russian build-up was primarily aimed at Japan.
Well, not aimed at it, but was the consequence of the defeat by Japan. You know, Russia and Japan have upset too. The Japanese decisively win in a humiliating manner. And the Russians say to themselves, well, we can't allow that to happen again. We've got to be ready for this kind of thing.
I think the flaw in that argument is where the money is coming from. Because I believe the vast amount of the sort of foreign investment for Russia's build-up was coming from France.
Yes.
I'm quite sure France doesn't want it directed against Japan, thank you very much. I think it wants that money and that build-up to be directed against Russia, sorry, Germany.
Yes. Which reinforces the point that the Germans wouldn't have liked it.
No, indeed.
Why were the Russian... Maybe the argument I'm offering goes like this, that the Russians felt a need for a general strengthening of their military. The only way they could pay for that was that the French were willing to help them. So they accepted that help. And if that meant, so to speak, pointing their army more at Germany and less at Japan, well, so be it. But if they've got a railway system, they can change that whenever they want.
I think Russia was much more concerned about Austria and the Balkans.
Yes, and well, many historians the fact that they sided with Serbia suggests that, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, this idea of being sort of head Slav, head boy Slav, was pretty important to them.
Yes.
So I think that was the key thing. And they, well, they also had this idea that they were going to take the Ottoman, the straits from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean. That was a big idea that the Russians had.
They have had.
So that was another part of it. I can't think of any particular antagonism that Russia and Germany had. I can't think of any sort of flashpoints between the two prior to the war.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that the Russians didn't intend to frighten the Germans, but they did. By their general build-up, so that they could deal with problems like Japan and also the Balkans, where they were focused. And they hadn't realised that by focusing on these things, building up their military power, they would frighten the Germans.
But isn't... I mean, shouldn't policy... I mean, let's put it like this. 100 years ago, Britain might have been aware that America was getting more powerful.
Yes.
And it did get more powerful. And it could have been threatened by that, but it wasn't. Or maybe it did feel threatened at various parts.
I think it did feel threatened. I mean,
But it was able to adjust its policy to take account of this, to accommodate the growth of the United States. Why wasn't Germany able to accommodate Russia becoming more powerful?
Yes. Well, one answer is that the Germans had a model of imperial and national success that didn't make it possible for them to do that.
No. This is one thing I think about a lot, is we haven't talked about Alsace-Lorraine at all, but
yes,
to my mind, without that issue, there is no way the First World War can happen. Because then, if without Alsace-Lorraine, there is no real dispute between France and Germany. What was I going to say about Alsace-Lorraine? Oh, drat, I can't remember now.
Well, legitimacy. That the French and the Germans were... The French were constantly aroused by the fact that, as far as they were concerned, it wasn't right for the Germans to rule Alsace-Lorraine.
Yes, and...
I mean, the very name is a clue.
Right, I can remember what my point is. The point is that had Germany given Alsace-Lorraine to France, there is no First World War. It's almost impossible to imagine. But Germany cannot do that, because it looks weak.
Did the French investment in Russia happen because they regarded Germany as an inevitable antagonist, potentially? Would the French investment in Russia had happened without the Alsace-Lorraine quarrel?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Yes.
I don't think there was any source of antagonism. However, I say that, and then immediately I think of the two Morocco crises, which seemed to have nothing to do with Alsace-Lorraine, which were examples of antagonism between France and Germany outside Alsace-Lorraine. So maybe there could have been, but I think those those events were more related to Alsace-Lorraine than we think.
I see.
I think it was Germany trying to do one over. Well, France originally trying to expand its influence in Morocco, and Germany trying unsuccessfully both times to reduce it.
When
rather
was
clumsily. Well, the first one was 1905, and the second one was 1911, I think. But aside,
what we're seeing is a sort of gradual build-up of hostilities, military power, and then the unpredictable effects of the mere existence of military power, because it frightens people when they see it. Hmm. And it doesn't matter how much you say your intentions are not to use it to attack whatever country it is that's frightened. Intentions can change overnight, and power, if it exists, can be used with a different decision.
Sorry, Brian, I'm trying to.
I'm trying to understand the escalation that went into the beginning of the First World War, and that seems to be the story all the time of how the situation was bad, and then it got worse, and then it got worse,
yes.
And then it got worse again, and finally it all kicked off. And I'm beginning to see how that happened. And one of the causes of it is that the world wasn't divided into two unchanging teams of protagonists. It was divided into a multiplicity of different decision makers. And in such a world, escalation can happen more easily. I'm now comparing
because A builds up against B, not
yes.
realizing that C is
yes.
threatened by it. So C builds up. So there's a certain
and decides to have a war. At which point D becomes nervous, very nervous, and joins in.
Yeah.
D being Britain.
Yeah.
Well, let's just say that the contrast is with the Cold War, isn't it? Where both teams, because of the denouement that they did not want of an out-and-out nuclear war. One of the things they did was to keep their allies very much on side.
As in,
the Soviets used a lot of effing and blinding and shouting and tanks and invasions to make sure their quote-unquote allies were on the same page as them. And the Americans made major economic sacrifices to keep their allies on the same page with them, as well as using a bit of stick as well as carrot. But the Americans used lots of carrots to keep their allies. An arrangement which is right now starting to look unnecessary with regard to Europe, because Europe's not in the front line of the conflict the Americans are now deep into against China. So what are they doing propping up Germany with vast amounts of money, with soldiers there just doing nothing but patronizing German tourist industry and, you know, eating in German restaurants and things? When the money could be better spent on America and on China. But for a long time, throughout the Cold War, the Americans were very concerned to keep their allies thinking in the same way they were, so that their allies wouldn't start battles that would escalate into World War III, or if there was even the slightest chance of that happening. Whereas before World War I, there wasn't this overriding sense that a great war was something you had to avoid. You had to avoid, no matter what. A great war was more like a thing you had to prepare for, had to be ready for, and be willing to fight.
I think to be, you know, to give the politicians of the time some credit, they were nervous.
Hmm.
They were very nervous about this. And I think there are a number of examples with the Kaiser and British politicians too. And the Tsar, very nervous about what they were doing.
Mm.
And often feeling rather forced into things. It was they only acted as they did when they really felt they absolutely had to.
Mm.
And their honour and their whole position was at stake. Their position in the world was at stake. So, yes, but I mean, obviously a nuclear war is a far more frightening event than a First World War.
Mm.
Even if you know exactly what the First World War is going to be like.
Well, the usual complaint that people had about the one of the ways I've heard it put is that politicians don't want to lose their sons. But as you pointed out many times to me, they were willing to lose their sons in the First World War.
Yes, they were.
They showed themselves to be willing to make that pretty nearly ultimate sacrifice. Think of what, I believe, Rudyard Kipling lost a son.
Well, Asquith lost his son. The leader of the Irish Nationalists lost a son.
Yes. You know, but the difference between that and World War III is that, the one that never happened, is that World War III doesn't just kill all your sons and you, it also destroys everything you believe is the point of anything.
Yeah, it destroys your civilization.
Yes, and that's something else again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And there were so that degree of fear of all-out war, there was plenty of fear of all-out war, but it wasn't sufficient, is what I think we have to say about that time.
No, no.
To stop a world war.
No.
What about, okay, Russian motives? I think I understand their military build-up better now than I did, especially the idea that the Japanese war against Russia and the fact that the Russians lost it indirectly contributed to the First World War happening, because it meant that the Russians felt they needed to become more militarily formidable, which they duly did, and that frightened the Germans and so on. Now, what about the Germans? In the earlier podcast, we discussed how we discussed it again now, haven't we, that they had a sort of time limit beyond which they couldn't attack Russia because they just would lose.
Yes.
How serious were they about attacking Russia anyway? You know, was this with Hitler, we all know, there was a huge attack on Russia, which he clearly planned and set in motion and then did.
The whole of the Schlieffen Plan is an attempt to solve the Russian problem. How do we win a war against Russia? Is essentially the question that's being asked there.
And did the Schlieffen Plan dominate German thinking before it got unleashed, or was it merely one of these plans, like the plan the British had for fighting a war against the Americans, which they did have? You know, there was a filing cabinet with a plan in it for what to do about a war against America. But that doesn't mean that sort of thinking dominated British thought.
That is a very good question, because we have different versions of this. One of our problems is there is no document called the Schlieffen Plan. We don't have it. It doesn't exist. It may have existed at some stage, but it was destroyed. And we don't know exactly what Moltke's plan was. He was the successor to Schlieffen, the chief of staff.
What I'm asking is not so much what was the plan. I'm asking what was the status of the plan in the larger picture of German policy making. Was it a minor precaution at one end of the scale, or was it a major preoccupation? Was it something that all German policy was bent towards bringing about, or was it merely one of many policies which Germany had to deal with this or that circumstance?
As far as I know, it's one of these examples of where, when the politicians have to start talking to the military, they don't get the answers they're expecting. Because the German politicians, cook this up, and then they start talking to the German generals. And it would appear that the German generals just decided to sort of, essentially lie about what was possible and tell them that the Schlieffen Plan was the only game in town. That's the only possible way of fighting this war, when it would appear that actually there were many other ways of fighting the war had they had the flexibility.
That's interesting. When we talk about World War II, which we've done in these things at various points, the picture of Germany being brilliant at the tactical level and pretty good at winning battles, but crucially lacking at the very top end of the system.
Yes, this is an example of that.
You're saying the same thing about
yes.
the pre-war Germans.
Yeah. German strategy in the First World War is a succession of clutching at straws, if that's grammatical.
Yes. Yes.
You know, if they start with the Schlieffen Plan, that doesn't work. They go on to beating Russia, that doesn't work. They go on to the Ludendorff Plan via the unrestricted U-boat warfare. None of these things work.
What about Bismarck? Did he understand all this better than his successors?
Ah, I have in the past said that Bismarck was against the annexation of Alsace-Lorraine.
When did Bismarck get dismissed?
1890.
Right, got it.
It was 2 years after Wilhelm came to the throne.
I see. Good. So, am I right in thinking that the rot set in with the removal of Bismarck?
It does seem to have done. I mean, the first thing that happens is that the sort of three-cornered treaties with Russia and Austria end. Because before that, Germany had made it very clear, if Austria goes to war with Russia, it will fight for the Russians. If the Russians go to war with Austria, they will fight with the Austrians. And because they were bigger than anyone else, the two didn't go to war. But it dumped the Russian part of it and became a much stronger ally with Austria. Why? I don't know. And I can't get to the bottom of that one, but they did. And that, of course, makes... and that happened in 1890 or 1891.
Well, it would switched from a policy of peace as the priority to one of national aggrandizement as the priority, with peace coming second, if that.
Maybe. It took an awfully long time for the national aggrandizement to come about. I can only imagine
they
could do that.
Well, it never came about. I mean, it was a failure. The Germans did do horribly well against the Russians at the beginning of the First World War and in the 2 years that followed, didn't they?
Oh, tremendously well, yes.
Yes. Solzhenitsyn had written great big books about this.
Yes, yes. Well worth a read, actually, August 1914.
Right. Haven't read them myself. What does Solzhenitsyn say? That it was...
Basically, the Tannenberg campaign was a right mess, pretty much from the start. That the Russians were disorganised, and the Germans were much better. I can't remember what else he said.
Well, that's enough to be going on with.
Yeah, and not. I think the main thing I remember was that Samsonov was just in the wrong place, because a general has to be at the centre of his communications, and Samsonov was not at the centre of his communications, so couldn't control, insofar as any First World War general could control what was going on the battlefield.
Yeah.
How do we get onto that?
I think I digressed into it. I apologise.
Yeah, we were talking about sort of German strategy, weren't we, and stuff like that.
Well, the big question for me is that the overall direction of German policy post-Bismarck, I get the impression, following the things you say about how Germany was a kind of decorated monarchy, decorated in the sense of decorated by the trappings of a republic, but fundamentally a monarchy.
Yes.
But a severely constrained monarchy. I mean, in the previous conversation, you talked about how the Kaiser had gone off to Russia and had all sorts of, made all kinds of promises. And when he got home, he was told, no, I'm sorry, you can't do that.
Oh, did I say that? I think it was the other way around.
Yes.
In that, I think the Tsar, it was made very clear to the Tsar, look, we have had so much help from the French, and we have made so many commitments to them, we can't back out now because no one will trust us.
Was there this mismatch between the Kaiser's view of things and the sort of nascent German Republic view of things? Were they in perpetual conflict?
I believe the Socialists had a majority in Parliament. At the outbreak of the war, I believe that's the case. I'd have to look it up. And so there's always that threat, and they're less inclined to war, although they got behind it quickly enough when it happened. And
of course, in foreign policy matters, uncertainty about your intentions can be as damaging as the certainty that your intentions are bad. The mere fear that they might turn bad because of confusion is enough to frighten your potential adversaries. I mean, always the case of the British against the Germans is not, we know what the Germans will do if we don't have a war against them. It's, if we don't have a war against them, we don't know what they'll do. It's what they might do that's enough to get the British fighting.
Yes, I guess that would be, I think that would be correct. And that's true in the Second World War as well.
And you can say similar things about the British. I mean, one of the most interesting things you said in the previous conversation was that the British were looked to be in a state of right old confusion and weakness because of the Irish question.
Yeah.
And that the idea that Britain was a sort of superlatively governed idyll of punting on the Thames was a bit of an illusion, in fact a large illusion. And that made the Germans, frankly, not very fearful of Britain joining in the First World War.
I've certainly heard that one, and of course I've also heard the one where there's a point in the July crisis where the Kaiser is convinced that Britain is not going to get involved and orders champagne to be opened.
Wow.
So
how does he get that idea?
Oh, I can't remember. It's probably some confusing telegram at some point. I can't remember. Might have to look that one up.
That's terrible, isn't it? I didn't know that.
Mm.
I must have read it somewhere. But there's so much to read about all these things that I forget bits of it.
Well, I mean, the older I get, the more I realise I don't know when it comes to the origins of the First World War. I mean, it's enormous.
Yes, I mean, the bottom line is that causation is not a linear process. An amazing number of people talk about causation as if it was a linear process. The chief culprit of them all being Sherlock Holmes. The chain of reasoning. Reasoning does not come in chains, it comes in trees. To be pedantic and literal about it, if something happens, nothing else can be deduced from that something unless you combine it with something else. You have to have two things to happen before you can derive from it anything else. Now, what that
can
means
you give an example?
That, well, if Russia decides to mobilize and back the Serbs against the Austrians, it is necessary for the Russians not to be too frightened of what the Germans will make of that. If they are frightened, they hesitate. If they're not sufficiently frightened of what the German reaction might be, they barge in and do it anyway. Or they get ready to do it.
So there's one thing is mobilisation.
The
other thing is
friendliness towards the Serbs and their eagerness to back them against the Austrians. And the other is their belief about what effect, if any, this will have on Germany. And because they don't fear Germany enough or don't take into account the German attitude in response to what they're doing, therefore they do it. But if they had, they might have hesitated. There's an example of what looks like just one event, which is Russia siding with Serbia and starting to mobilize. It's got to be combined with the Russian attitude to Germany, which is one of, frankly, neglect, you know, not realizing until it's too late what this might do to the Germans, even if it's only giving them an excuse to start a war that the Germans wanted anyway, if that's what they wanted.
It's perhaps worthwhile pointing out that actually Russia did get what it wanted in that respect, because at the end of the war, Serbia gets a lot bigger and Austria gets a lot smaller.
Well,
I mean, I quite agree. The war did not. It's an expensive way of getting what you want.
That's what I was thinking. They got a lot of other things they didn't want.
Yes, indeed. Although a lot of that goes back to the Russian attitude to Austria, which was that, you know, well, similar to Hitler's view of Soviet Russia, you know, one kick and the whole thing will fall down.
Yes.
And they were right about it, actually.
They were right with regard to the Tsarist regime, weren't they?
Mm. But the Russians were right about the Austrians.
Yes, yes. So, in other words, Austrian weakness was a factor in this, perceived weakness by the Russians.
Yes, yes. And the Serbs, it must be said.
Yes, if the Austrians had been a formidable empire and they'd said, Serbia, behave yourself, Serbia would have behaved itself.
Yeah.
But Austria wasn't strong enough to make that stick.
No, indeed not.
Which, of course, leads on to another cause of all this, which is the rise of nationalism, which was arguably what did for the Austrian Empire in the first place and turned it into a weak empire as opposed to a much stronger one as it had been in the past. The rise of the distinct languages of the empire, as opposed to the single language of Germany and Britain, and Russia for that matter.
That was quite true.
There are other
problem.
Languages in all these places, but there's one very dominant language, whereas in the Austrian Empire, the German language of the Austrians was insufficiently dominant to keep the empire together. Let's put it that way.
Yes. I was thinking about this before we were recording, and it occurs to me the rot set in 1867. Now, in 1866, Austria had lost a war against Prussia, and in 1867, the Hungarians had some sort of rebellion, and the solution was to give Hungary autonomy, which is why when you get the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that term coming in. And
yes,
that was the death knell of the whole thing. Because as soon as you accept one nationality has its autonomy, well, why not the others? Very difficult to argue all of a sudden. And, of course, Austria is nothing but lots of nationalities all over the place. So, I mean, even Franz Ferdinand was trying to give Slavs a certain amount of autonomy on the Hungarian model. But the point is, you're allowing this nationalist idea to creep in into a monarchy. And I mean, of course, monarchies are saying, well, deriving their legitimacy from God. God has chosen us, or we just happen to. So you must obey us. Whereas nationalism is saying, no, the state should be constituted on a national basis.
Serve the nation and the people of the nation.
Yes. Exactly.
And it's worth pointing out that in the latter half of the 19th century, there were all kinds of things that were making a new kind of nationalism very prominent and somewhat unprecedented. I mean, it's very interesting you picked on a date in the 1860s of this. Another major event that happened in the 1860s was that the British National Railway system was completed, pretty much, and that led to the creation of the British National Press. And similar events happened elsewhere in Europe. And once one nation starts nationalising, so to speak, it's going to cause a cascade, isn't it?
I would take slight issue with the idea of a national press. It's very interesting to read The Times from, say, 1914, which is very much a London paper, whereas The Manchester Guardian is very much a Manchester paper. But I won't quibble. I mean, yes, there's a press and there is a nation.
And there are novelists and poets and people like this. I mean, the whole German story illustrates it as well. The way that language became more and more important and therefore more divisive in Europe than it had been.
Yes.
Countries like France went from being a hodgepodge of different languages to being one very dominant language.
Yes, I believe they used pretty brutal methods to make sure that people spoke French.
Yes.
Which you don't think of, do you? You think the French have spoken French for, well, forever, but...
Well, some of them have.
Mm, yeah, the Northerners,
but
I think, isn't it?
Down south, it's very different, or it was.
Yeah, that's how I understand it. And I wonder...
This is the sort of reason. It's because of the... root-like nature of logic rather than the chain-like nature of logic. Events on their own cause nothing. Only events in combination cause anything to happen, literally anything. And the First World War is a horribly good example of all this because, I mean, I looked up, I asked the internet, what was the cause of World War One? I asked it last night. And it basically was a long list of all the circumstances which, shall we say, didn't help. Number one was treaty obligations. Number two was imperialism, which, well, it didn't help that all the big nations of Europe were quarreling with each other in an imperial fashion. Even Germany, which was trying to get into the imperial story, was threatening to the existing imperialists. And that was all part of the story. How big a part is open to debate. I don't think it's as big as the way that Germany threatened actually Britain itself, but it's clearly a part of the story, and it goes on like that. There's been an argument about to what extent railway timetables were irreversible I'm very sceptical about that. I think if you have to...
Let me put it like this. There was actually a general at the time, his name was von Staub, and he wrote a book after the war saying, had we wanted to go in a different direction in 1914, we could have done it.
Yes.
So I am, you know, as sure as I can be that that is bollocks, you know, not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah, in the previous conversation, we declared the theory that the First World War happened by accident because of train timetables as an excuse for the people who actually chose to start it.
Yeah, exactly.
But who didn't want to admit that that's what they did.
Yeah.
I mean, that in itself is a big statement about the First World War.
Yeah. And conveniently, von Moltke, who, you know, would be the chief culprit in this, died during the war, so we'll never know.
Well, the Second World War, I forget whether we ourselves talked about this, but the fact that Hitler died at the end of the Second World... No, it's not. It wasn't us. It was that guy, Tick, T-Y-K.
Yeah. T-I-K, isn't it?
Is it T-I-K, sorry?
The Imperator King, I believe, is the...
That's it, yes, T-I-K. He says that because Hitler was Hitler and he died, the German military leadership after the Second World War were able to retrospectively declare that all the mistakes made by Germany were made by Hitler.
Yes,
when this clearly wasn't the case.
Yes, but it's taken 70 years to come out this sort of stuff. It's amazing, isn't it?
His particular example being the quarrel between Hitler and, was it Halder, about the primacy of the attack on the oil fields of the Ukraine, which Hitler wanted to happen at the expense of all other aspects of the offensive against Russia, and Halder didn't. And Halder was, without, given the situation Germany was in, and Hitler's Germany in particular, Halder was wrong, and Hitler was right. If the Germans had done what Hitler wanted them to do, which was to concentrate on the Ukraine,
The Caucasus. War would have been,
the Caucasus, yeah. Yes, sorry. The relevance of this tangent being that it illustrates the way that fateful decisions get misrepresented afterwards when it is clear that they were so very fateful. And the biggest lie is that the First World War started because nobody knew how to stop it. Plenty of people knew how to stop it, they just chose not to.
Yes. I mean, I would make a case for the First World War. I know this is
Be careful. That sounds a bit scandalous. Go ahead, please make it. That's what these things are for.
But I would point out that the Europe that came about, the Europe of say 1920, minus communism, is pretty much the Europe we have today.
Yes.
Or to a large extent, it is. I mean, the idea of the nation state is a very strong one and hasn't gone away. And the idea of liberal democracy hasn't gone away entirely. And the idea of the idea of monarchs and empires has gone. That's completely. And, it'd be lovely if these things came about peacefully, but they don't seem to. You seem to need the crucible of war in order to decide who's right, which is... it'd be nice if it wasn't that way, but in most of these big changes, you're going to have a big war at some stage, it seems to me.
Yeah.
That's humanity, and I'm quite happy to believe that human progress does involve two steps forward, one step back occasionally. Horribly if you're involved in it.
Yes, if you're one of the backward steps.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, I agree, and I think that's one of the reasons why it makes sense for people, us in particular, to still scratch over the details of the war side of things, because that hasn't stopped necessarily.
Let me put it another way. I mean, this is just emphasizing stuff. Do we really think? I mean, what if the Austrian Empire had just carried on? I mean, that seems an absurdity. I mean, surely at some stage it's going to collapse. And I mean, unless there's a threat of a nuclear war over everyone, well, it's probably going to involve a war. You'd have thought. I mean, not least because a lot of people have vested interests in a monarchy. You know, all those dukes and archdukes and know, people with fancy titles in the army.
So it made me think of the European Union now, actually. Again, a multilingual bodge, the sort of German-French empire, so to speak.
The Franco-German empire.
Between the Germans and the French.
Mm-hmm.
Is it inevitable that that will break up for the same reasons?
It's remarkably long-lasting, isn't it?
Isn't it?
The fact that Britain has left has not encouraged anyone else to go.
Well, that's because of the way the EU handled it. I know we're changing the subject appallingly, and I apologise to all those who want us only to be talking about the First World War and why it started, which is what we advertise this as, but just to mention in part...
Well, we don't care what anyone thinks, do we? We just have a
chat.
Well,
I do.
All right,
okay. I think we should care a little. I prefer it when we stick to the matter in hand, but I just want to mention in passing, I've just finished reading Steve Davies's book about the politics and the economics and politics of Brexit, which is about the EU negotiations with Britain. And he makes the point that the EU's handling of the negotiations with Britain were thoroughly consistent. You know, there were limits they were not prepared to go through, and they kept on saying it, and the British kept on deluding themselves about whether this or that deal would be possible when it clearly wasn't.
Yeah.
It's a very good book.
Yeah, I can very easily believe that. We were talking about the similarities
between
the EU and Austria.
By the way, again, this is a horrible digression. Again, apologies to those who hate digressions. But one of the things you said in our discussion about the EU was, what the hell were the Remainers thinking that they didn't take a soft Brexit? And
yes,
to cut a long story short, read Steve Davies's book, and I think you get several very good answers to that question.
Oh.
One of them, for example, is that the leave tendency was concentrated in particular places. Therefore, more leavers were of the kind who didn't know anyone who disagreed with them, whereas Remainers tended to know leavers.
Isn't it the other way around? I thought the big problem about the Remainers is they'd never met a leaver.
The Remainers were living in a bubble.
Yeah.
Concentrated bubbles of monochrome thinking, whereas the Remainers were more aware of the existence of people who didn't agree with them.
The leavers were more aware of people who
God almighty. You were muddling up Russia and Germany.
Yes,
I'm not doing it with the leavers
and
Remainers. I apologise, everybody.
Yeah.
However many dozens of you it is. But, yes. Well, I should have stopped where I said read that book, because I think it's a good one for you to read.
Mm, yeah, that sounds it. Yeah. I mean, certainly when it comes to the EU, yes, it's multilingual. Yes, it doesn't seem particularly strong. I don't know. But it hangs about. And it doesn't claim that its existence is justified by God or something like that.
It says something like that, I think. It alludes to principles which only barbarians would dissent from. You know, it's a bad thing to have a world war in Europe. Therefore, you should support the European Union. Nobody's going to contest that by saying, no, it's a good idea to have a European war. Let's have one. To hell with the EU.
No.
It's a complicated argument. I mean, the falsehood is the claim that the EU is stopping world wars. I don't think that's the case. I think they're stopping for other reasons.
I think that still seems to me to be a very long way away from the monarchical argument.
Yes, it is.
So it's something different, and I.
But the EU story, the story that Davies tells in this book reminds me a little bit of the decision making before the First World War, in the following sense, that a crucial part of the decision making that happened between, say, 2015 and now, was that that large swathes of the British ruling class were just stupid and ignorant. I mean, he uses the word delusional quite frequently to describe the way they were thinking.
Deluded about what?
About the nature of the leave mentality.
Leavers are leavers, or the strength and depth of feeling of leavers.
The assumption that the Remainers were right and that it was only necessary for them to explain to the benighted populace how right they were, and that would be the end of that. Well, this wasn't true. First of all, they weren't as well-informed as they thought they were, and as a result, they made strategic blunders. So this can happen, is the point.
Davies is mostly
very willing to acknowledge the rationality of the key decision makers throughout this period. The leaders of the Labour Party, the leaders of the Conservative Party, and above all, the rulers of the EU, all of those contending parties are presented as making reasonable decisions in very difficult circumstances, especially the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, who had very tricky circumstances to navigate.
Well, I'll give an example.
The hardcore Remainers, who he says were just incorrigibly stupid.
I mean, I will say this, I did sort of war game this, is how Cameron could have won that referendum. And I came to the conclusion he could never have won it. Because he, you know, essentially, I mean, he'd lost it, I think, the moment he had that renegotiation in which the EU humiliated him.
Yes, but Davis's response to that is to say, but the EU didn't humiliate him in a passing whim because it didn't like him or something. It humiliated him because it was absolutely necessary for them to do that. There were certain principles they had to stand up for. And if they didn't, they would have signed the death warrant of the entire project.
Yeah.
So therefore, it wasn't them being casual. And furthermore, they kept on insisting on these principles through three different prime ministerships.
Yes.
So it wasn't personal, exactly.
No. We seem to be actually praising the EU for sticking to its principles.
I'm more to point, Davies is praising him. I want to distinguish between me praising them and him praising them. In that respect, it's pretty persuasive what Davies says.
Yeah.
And it illustrates the point that even though most of the contending parties in this contretemps were doing the very best they possibly could in a very tricky situation, nevertheless, if you regard the EU losing one of its three major tripod legs, so to speak, in the form of Britain, if you think that was a disaster, it was a disaster that still happened, despite the best efforts of all sorts of people to stop it happening. And, of course, that applies also to the beginning of the First World War, doesn't it? More so.
Yes. I'm trying to think how... Yes.
Well, these people were not completely oblivious to the terrors of what World War One became. They were worried.
Yes.
But they were as worried about other things like national honour.
And regime survival and stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Indeed. For example, the German army did not want to expand as much as it could be. It could have done before the First World War because that would have allowed the riffraff to become officers.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Yeah, that's.
If they had expanded more, is that going to have mattered? Because then they would have expanded the navy less and antagonised the British less.
That would certainly have helped.
Because one of the things that got the British very nervous about the Germans was the naval build-up, wasn't it? I mean, that whole dreadnought business.
It was a crazy thing to do because it. Oh, by the way, when you were talking about how actions against one power can have consequences with another, I think this is one of the issues with the German naval build-up. Because, yes, it's just about possible that the Germans only intended to use it... No, it's not. I was going to say the Baltic. But the Germans wanted a presence in the Baltic. And it's possible they could only threaten the Russians in the Baltic... At the same time, also threatening the British. Well, that seems slightly implausible because the British Navy was much, much bigger than the Russian. Quality and quantity.
As I know to my personal cost in my present medical life, often what matters is not the actual state of things, but the direction in which things are moving.
Yes.
And if Germany goes from being a zero naval power to a 30% naval power and does it quite quickly, that's scary to the 100% naval power.
Yes.
However irrational they may be being about that, you can see why they're frightened.
As it happens, Germany was a two-thirds naval power.
Yes.
Which is,
yes. But it doesn't need much in the way of expansion if the direction is rapid in the direction you don't want. That's indeed. A world in which people start saying, in 5 years' time, the Germans are going to be, you know, they're going to have this many ships and so on.
And then you get campaigns with the slogans, we want eight, we won't wait.
Yes.
So, yeah, indeed.
Well, rather to my surprise, we've discussed quite a lot of things which we didn't discuss in the previous one, which is a relief to me because I feared we would, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, I feared that we would simply come up with a conversation which would cause both of us to recommend the previous one.
I'll have to re-listen to it because I didn't. I
committed my perennial sin of talking too much because I do, but I didn't. I mean, there weren't the horrible digressions that we've had in this one, but we covered lots of interesting points and covered each of them once and did it rather well, I think, in that previous conversation. But somewhat to my surprise, we found other things to emphasize in this one, which I'm pleased about.
Good. Any other questions or
questions?
Thoughts?
Let me think. Yes. In the previous one, we talked about Ireland and about how Ireland was at daggers drawn with Britain before the First World War, which caused the Germans to underrate the British threat and might have caused them to do rash things in terms of antagonizing Britain. But what about the Irish attitude during the First World War? Ulster Unionists were enthusiastic warriors, and then when enthusiasm had died down, they became still very effective warriors, didn't they?
To the best of my knowledge, yes. I mean, you've got to remember that conscription was never introduced in Ireland. And after the Easter Rising and the Somme, recruitment...
1916.
Recruitment from Ireland into the army collapsed.
Yes. There had been quite a lot of recruitment from what is now Southern Ireland.
Yes.
Into the British Army. Because Ireland was then part of Britain, wasn't it?
Yes.
When did partition happen?
1922.
Yes. So the attitude of the Irish people altered during the First War, but crucially not at the beginning. Or not
well,
enough.
We've got to remember where. I mean, it's very odd. Trying to pin it down is difficult because you have in 1910 the general election, with the exception of the university seats, all of what's now the Republic voted nationalist, more or less. Whereas in 1918, the same area votes Sinn Féin entirely, more or less. So there's that change has happened. But at the same time, in August 1914, the leader of the Irish Nationalists, who's Redmond, says, OK, we'll put all these arguments to one side, we'll come back to them, we will fight this war together, and encourages people, as I remember, to join the British Army. Mm. So there's a huge change in Irish attitudes between 1940. Well, to some extent. I mean, they want to be independence.
Yes.
At very least autonomy, and that's probably a staging post for independence in 1914. In 1918, it's clearer. It's a much more anti-British attitude you have by 1918.
Mm. Mm. It sounds a bit like what happened in the Second World War with colonial people generally.
Yeah, I mean, in that they were prepared to fight for the empire, thought it might be a good thing, and by the end they thought, not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The same kind of movement.
Although it wasn't in the Second World War, and wasn't the sort of the Singapore such a big aspect in this? Whereas in the First World War, I can't think of anything similar.
Well, I mean, surely the big slaughters on the Western Front.
Mm, but they're not defeats as such.
No, but they're, well, they put it mildly, they're disappointments.
Let's say that. Yeah.
And Singapore was a disappointment in addition to being a disaster. That's clarified something for me. I hadn't appreciated, I just hadn't thought properly about Ireland during the First World War. I've been typically Anglo-centric in the way I've thought about it. So thanks for that. Any other questions? Was there any thought that the Americans might join in long before they actually did in the First World War?
I can't think of a point. I mean, it's worth pointing out that Woodrow Wilson won the presidential election in 1916 on a platform of he kept us out of the war.
Yes.
Whereas Roosevelt, I think, was all in favour of joining.
Well, he said that beforehand, didn't he?
Did he?
I think he said we've got to stay out of these things until he decided that actually they had to join in. I think he was quite a canny politician, i.e. clever at telling lies. I don't really know the story of Roosevelt's inner thoughts, but it was a bit like what you've described Wilson doing. Certainly American policy was, let's keep out of this, until eventually they were persuaded they had to join in.
Yeah.
And that happened in the Second World War also. The joining in phase was a bit bigger on that occasion. But my point is, did any of this get foreseen by Germany?
Not that I'm aware of.
No.
But then again, until the Americans actually got involved, I mean, before the war, the United States just was not a European player. No one, hardly anyone ever considered it to be. Although, of course, effectively, America was part of the Allies right from the start because of the food and armaments it sent over. And they were only going to go to one place, to one side. So there's that. But I don't think the Germans ever really considered that as an issue, as a factor.
But they certainly had the Battle of the Atlantic in mind as something they were going to have to fight in the First World War. Once the British and the Germans were seriously stuck into each other, the Germans started thinking about submarines, didn't they? Or before that, they'd been thinking about the submarines.
I believe the submarines were a bit of an afterthought because they're spending so much time building battleships rather than submarines. And battleships look so much better than submarines. Was an issue.
The more I study the First World War and the Second World War, the more I see the similarities. The same themes keep getting repeated.
Yes, yes.
They were basically, I think, in future, historians will think of them as two wars that were the same war.
Yes, I think there's a good chance.
Well, I don't think I have any more questions I want to ask. Thank you very much. I've learnt quite a bit from this.